Ellis has been president for 19 years, and Fred Bellcrom has been the treasurer. Both have experience in Prairie. Jamie in the more general sense, and more pragmatic sense, perhaps. Fred is an entomologist, but not a a taxonomy, just entomologist, an entomologist who was looking at the physiology of muscles and nerves. So more a neurologist than anything else. And he and his wife, or his wife, Nancy, is on the Urbana Park District Board for many years, and they traveled, and they have a daughter married in New Zealand, so they get there from time to time, and Fred takes lots of photographs. They decided to buy a plot of land at Myra Station. Myra Station is interesting because there used to be a railroad line that connected Urbana with Sydney. It was 8 miles long, and it went through Myra Station. And at one stage, there was a big elevator at Myra Station, a big wooden elevator. It got taken down. It was kind of a junction area. But some people have kept the nature of that railroad line afloat. It had some difficulties for acquisition in that it was warranty deeds, which is a little bit different from a warranty deed, but it made it fairly positive that people could take back their own land if the railroad retired, which it did. They had lots of bridge ties and the like, and we were involved with some of that, but that line is partially now a golf course in development, and it had various iterations in Urbana. People didn't like it going through the housing at an angle, so it was moved a little to the east and went down by the county seat and then joined up with the previous right-of-way near Prairie Gardens. And then near Prairie Gardens, there was a nice little prairie in the school. It's still there. And after many, many years, and enough to do some teaching. And I'm trying to think where I was headed there. We were at the Grand Prairie Friends meeting, and both Jamie and Fred were Bobsey twins, backing up on each other to talk about the establishment of a backyard prairie. And they have a book which is about backyard prairies, and it's very good, and it introduces people to the value of having natural areas. Chicago has done it a lot. They've perhaps had hundreds of habitat backyards, usually backyard, not a front yard. And they invite birds and bees and bacteria and fungi, and it's got some ambiance to it too. You can have a little plot. It might only be 10 by 10 or 15 by 15, but it's enough to have 10 or 15 different species, and it's kind of wonderful to see them grow It grows slowly if you plant them by seed. If you go to Prairie Moon and buy seed, or if you collect seed yourself on railroad beds, or if you buy in plants, that works too. So But you have to be careful because there are all sorts of creatures that will invade your little prairie, including in some places in town where deer come in. So it's the wildlife is able to survive, even though they've lost a lot of their dignity and they've lost a lot of their numbers, they still seem to be able to survive. And they, you plant them, but out of the woodwork come other creatures like insects. And this is, you wonder where they came from. But if you have contiguity between these plots, as we do on railroad lines, then creatures can move about, and they can mate, and they can find food source, and there are migratory birds and other creatures that can fly in or be temporary visitors to habitat. So that was the theme of the presentation, and they're working with the University of Illinois Farm Bureau complex, and that has computerization so that you can get good photography. And I was so pleased to see the lights go down, because often people who do good photography are faced by the fact that the exhibit area has lights that are almost permanently on, and it means that you don't really get a good look at the pictures. So this was good and well attended by people who are members of Grand Prairie Friends, or board members, or volunteers, or visitors. And I was impressed by the number of people there, and probably I would guess at least 50. And then the Grand Prairie Friends had a brochure. It was a very extensive brochure, and with a lot of artwork and a lot of detail and a lot to report. So after the presentation for the backyard prairie, there was a report by the four members that are employed by the Grand Prairie Friends, that showed what the Grand Prairie Friends was doing. And and it's gone from a start that had a lot of different people involved. You have to go back many years. So there's a couple of gung-ho Audubon people who did a lot of background work here that people don't know about because these people have moved on and passed on. But Katie and Lois were there. And Katie, yeah, they weren't at this meeting. They were long since passed. But they were early progenitors. And they did things like try to have an Audubon shop in downtown Champaign, which was losing its storefronts to the malls. People were moving out of the downtown to the malls, and so there were empty storefronts, and could we use those for Audubon? And so Katie Hamrick and Lois Drury put together, along with other people, a store that where people could come and get natural history information. And these couple were a powerhouse in other places. Lois was a teacher, and Katie, I forget where Katie was worked, but both of these people had a lot to offer. And you would have people that would comment that these people changed my life. In school, Lois would be handling people who didn't know quite what to do with themselves, and they had that sort of standing. And we decided. I'd come from Australia, and I couldn't really find the ecosystem easily, and got involved and stayed around, like other people happens to too. And we wanted something that would alert people to their ecosystem. Parkland College was not quite created yet. Parkland College was in some of these dead storefronts. It was in downtown Champaign. It was in churches and dotted around the community while it was decided where Parkland College would go and what it would be the design. So we started a reading the landscape course named after May Watts, who wrote a book called Reading the Landscape, and she knew we were using the title, and then she would be here every once in a while as a jury for landscape or architecture people who were doing design or planners, and she passed on, but the name implies going out in the landscape and seeing what's there. And many people don't take the time to do that, and sometimes they walk past historic monuments without really recognizing them. So we started a reading the landscape course, and Katie and Lois were there, and we had 29 people. And gradually over the years, it got to be distributed a little bit. Some of the information that we were wanting to see preserved went to a master naturalist program. And often done probably better than we would do, but our field trips were intriguing. And we had a professor from the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, who was head of the sculpture department at the time. He had a country house in Hinesboro down near Arcola. And somehow we got together, and he came on one of my field trips, and he thought this was a good idea. So he suggested that we institute a artist in the landscape, which we taught for many years, and I find that it has continued at the School of the Art Institute in a different iteration. But it's interesting that some of the things we do inspire others. So over the last few months, I've been trying to get to the point where people start out in the basement with a cup of coffee and a donut, and gradually move an idea And the state and the federal government supports this because people that do that often do have interesting ideas, and we've been working through that and getting perhaps a little bit more formal, and some people get very formal, and groups like the Nature Conservancy get to be national and international. It takes a fair bit of concentration and friends and relatives getting together, and it's not always perfect, but one of the endpoints is that we're getting to develop natural areas, and the Grand Prairie Friends, we should perhaps say where they were initiated. We instituted a prairie conference at Mahomet, and had a lot of volunteers to put that together and speakers. And it before and after, there was this suggestion that we might have a Grand Prairie Friends, a group of people who would get together. So in 1984, we were seated in and around Katie and Lois's house on Foley Street, and we put together the idea of who we might ask, and that was the creation of the Grand Prairie Friends. And so they formed very formally with 501c3 tax exemption, and they've taken off and done wonderful things. And so we also had in the background tried to find a natural area that we could use as demonstration. Wasn't easy because there's very little remnant prairie left around. So we worked with fishery area. We probably walked 100 miles just trying to find a good site that was, perhaps if we could get it close enough to town, people could visit it. And we found this railroad line between Fisher, or it came through from Leroy in the Bloomington area, and came through Foosland and through to Fisher and Dewey and Prospect and into Rantoul, and went across the Illinois Central line and headed towards Lafayette, Indiana. So there were little town, Dillsburg and Gifford, and this is a pumpkin vine. It was a wiggle woggle some. So it went across the road at Gifford and then through Gifford. And you have to know that there's some terrain involved. This was the Bloomington Moraine, and all the Frieslands and Deutschlands that knew to drain the flatland areas were there on the lowlands, but and the Irish especially were on the uplands, and that line went on to Armstrong and through into Indiana. It was retired. So we took lots and lots of photographs and videos and spent about 60 hours on that with a agency that was in an old IGA store in Urbana and near to the high school. It was an audiovisual center, and it had been established because Time Warner was asked to be providing services to the community, but they also were expected to have a an audiovisual center. And I had a good learning there because I had been using a visual material that was belonging to the organization rather than myself. So I left the video material where it was in the building, which I will never do again, because if you spent 60 hours editing with early printing devices to put information in, that's a lot of work. And the tapes that are just a small part of it, but somebody decided that the tapes were useful for something else, and we lost a lot of that early video material. So we bumble along and get things done, and we had a lot of involvement from the Fisher area, and we got to know people, and the high school put in a prairie, and it was a lot of general background interest that was behind the creation of a Grand Prairie Friends. It wasn't really the establishment, finally, it was just a concept. And so you have to honor concepts that often take off. So I had to sit there on Friday night and think that this concept had taken off. It had been morphed a little bit into forest, because forests are more interesting. But you too can do that sort of thing. You have to take time to know an area. You have to know the people. You have to know where they come from, how they think. You will encounter some royal opposition, but then you will encounter some support. So you just let it bounce off your back, and it sometimes will happen. And, so you see the spin-off to Artists in the Landscape. You see, we had an organization which predated some of it, which is called Educational Resources and Environmental Science. And it was based in, it was a curriculum lab at the University of Illinois. And it got its name because there was a grant to two institutions were going to get a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation for quite a substantial amount of money to concern environmental studies. And application had been made, and the Rockefeller Foundation said, your research is excellent and your teaching is good, but where is your extension work, where you take ideas out to the community? So we were visited. We had an organization called Natural Areas Instructional Development, encouraged by the botanists that I'd found and knew about prairies and knew about reconstruction prairies. And so it was known that we had an office supplied by the curriculum lab that they believed in what we were doing. And so probably about 8 administrative people, including heads of department, decided that we should be the extension arm for this project. And we were renamed Educational Resources in Environmental Science. The application was made for about 170 odd thousand, and we didn't exactly win the grant. But the name stuck, and so we have had educational resources and environmental science in the background for many, many years. And all sorts of people have contributed to that and helped us, helped to create or inspire a Grand Prairie Friends. Not always is that recognized, but we did get a conference. We did have field trips with that conference, and we got a short line. And Wendy Garrison was the first president. We knew her from before, and she was the first president. And so Wendy and her husband paid for the railroad right-of-way that we found at Gifford. And there were adjunct spaces that were interesting. There's cemetery hidden behind Penfield that was quite interesting. And there was a history here of early settlement. A good place to be, but very narrow. Probably not even 100 feet wide, and open to invasive by the farmland on either side. But it was a good start, and so that became the background for the creation of Grand Prairie Friends. And it's gradually grown. Didn't have a lot of money, but they got volunteer money to do this sort of work, and gradually the board had some people who are still around. Jim Payne is a leader. Other people were there that know the start of this organization. And so you wanted to get its own status. We didn't want to be breathing down anyone's neck with sorts and ideas. It was their own thing. And then gradually did very, very well. And the board members changed to some extent, but gradually they got grant money, the opportunity arrived to work with forested areas in Coles County. So that became Warblers Woods. So gradually, the meeting that we were at on Friday night, the staff people were explaining that these areas were adjacent to a city-owned water lake and water supply, and state land acquired on the banks of the Ombra River. And gradually, the Grand Prairie Friends have helped to coalesce this into a larger area. We are all very concerned that the only prairie that's left is usually along railroad lines and in cemeteries that haven't been attended or have reserve areas that have been prairie in the day when they were settled as a cemetery. The information was helpful, and gradually they've got to the point where they have I call it liatris, but it's a club That is depends on the Laetrius, Laetrius is a name, and each of the people in that club commit $1,000 to the club. They I'm trying to think of the name. As you get older, you forget things easily. So that club has been there, and many of them were at the meeting. And gradually, to do this sort of work, not only in Coles County, but other places like Villa Grove or in Watseka or Loder or Paxton, this has been preservation work, which in the long run requires $1 million and more, because it's not the sort of money that you can expect from local donations. Although sometimes big local donations, like donations of land for bat preservation and things like that. So we have to really applaud this situation. I walked out feeling very pleased, and I think you should be pleased too, because we have in the background land which is being challenged, and it includes habitat which is not the best. You have to know that if there's not much money to preserve things and the politics is not in favor of you, then it's very hard to do anything but gather up the little bit of gems that are really good. Then the secondary level prairies that exist but are not the best, but they're the only ones we have, are in jeopardy often, because they're not cared for in the same way as the more genuine plots, and it takes time. So we have a little prairie outside Allerton Park, which is quality enough that it is encouraged the university, which owns Allerton Park, to put in a mile by 66 feet of reconstruction prairie to encourage rattlesnakes that are endangered and to encourage other creatures. And after about 10 or 12 years, that corridor looks almost like a prairie adjacent to the more undisturbed railroad bed adjacent. And so there is a situation where there's a sporting field of 30 acres very near to a prairie, and it's near to a library, and the library has contributed 5 acres to a natural area, and it's very close to the railroad bed. But you have to know that the biologists are rather fearful of recreational use. Recreational use invariably is more important to most people who want to use it and enjoy it, but they're not quite so concerned about the prairie. It doesn't look as interesting as a mountain or even a tree. It's kind of looking weedy, and people have had to take it out in order to make it available for agriculture. And John Deere's had to invent a plow that could plow it. So there's a temptation to put a trail through this 2 or 3 mile segment, and Do you do that? Is that the sort of thing that the Grand Prairie Friends might take an interest in, along with land trust people, along with the extension of the city? The city has a nice little trail on Hutton Pathway's bed. And so you have to go back to thinking about where Heartland Pathways came into this. It came into it in about 1986, 1987, 1988, that sort of period, when the line had been adjudicated as abandoned. We had to work with the elevators that might use it. They decided not. So that was after we had an educational resources in environmental science and moved to downtown in a situation where we were more in a lockstep with the community. We had been servicing the community from the university base. We still service the university base when asked, and but it was a different sort of situation. And we learned to enjoy it, and we occupied spaces that were vacated by companies that were losing out to computerization, engraving people, and we were losing out to the malls. So actually, Heartland Pathways was bought after there was an educational resources, and after there was a Grand Prairie Friends. And, it was fairly near to a time when Allerton Park was being mooted for a flooding of Allerton Park and Friends Creek for a dam. And that didn't work, but a lot of these people were crisscrosses. And I had with me at the meeting Liz Rudnick, who was a volunteer in student days and knew this territory, and she lives and works in Massachusetts, but she's in town to visit her son, who is in electrical engineering and about to graduate. Liz herself has a PhD in this territory, and so we talked to John Marlin, who has also a PhD. That we were watching that sort of interaction. The universities have been always interested in people who are innovative and want to do something different. Doesn't always work, but so you always have people who are teachers who are also learning from their students. And in recent years, there has been a Beckman Institution, which partially is designed to encourage people to belong to teams. So if you're looking at climate and weather and tornadoes, you may be gathering up lots of computer data, because we have equipment these days that can go up in the air and anywhere without you having to actually occupy a tornado in order to find out what it's about. You have data people, you have people who are artists who can take that data and put it together and say, yes, this is a tornado, but it has these children. You see here and see here, and they can interpret, and So we're very definitely interested in artists and how they can interpret this in photography. So part of the meeting that we were at on Friday night was about that. And so Liz came to the meeting and we talked to John Marlin. His wife is mayor of Banner, and he has been in charge of hazardous waste and within the university, but he's retired and he does a lot of prairie preservation, especially on places like Route 45's house, or he has a nice plot of prairie on Florida Avenue. It's near to the president's house, and he cares for that, and he notices various creatures expressing themselves, and some of them are prairie plants themselves, native prairie plants that also are invasive. So you actually have to think about these plants. Ragweed is one of them. Goldenrod is another one. And they have cycles, and sometimes they grow a lot and sometimes they don't. But mostly ragweed especially is fairly permanent. If you cut it before it seeds, it won't have the energy to come back. So there are certain paradigms where you mow. If you plant the prairie, you wait till the weeds grow to almost seeding time, then you mow at about 6 inches high and you cut off all the seed heads, and there'll be some sprouts, but basically you're saving the soul of the prairie that's growing underneath. We have had this week to talk to Ameren because they're putting in poles on one of our prairies, and you have to think about when you're going to plant the seed. Do you plant it in the middle of winter so that it's underneath the snow and gets a start, and then it grows so slowly, roots first, and then the weeds, especially if it's been disturbed for poles, are going to have a riot, and you need to mow. So people think it's strange that we want to mow prairies, but you pick your time and you pick the organism. Sometimes mowing doesn't help. If you're dealing with Canada thistle, you chop it up into little pieces and all the little pieces like grow. So you have to sort out those techniques. You have to watch. You can infuse into a fairly diverse prairie some new plants, but some of those new plants need to be almost in a greenhouse. And you have to be aware that some of the plants that you might plant after 3 years are in the palate of deers. So you almost have to have a fence around your little plot of prairie so that that deer won't check out your menu. And so you can actually lose some of your plants that you cherish. So we've been talking this week about those aspects, the possibility of putting a road cut into the prairie, and the possibility of putting a trail through the prairie that's a couple of miles long. That's a challenge. Then we have to think of the regional nature of this. So, concept of 30 acres for the ballpark is interesting, but it's the concept of having a natural area nearby is interesting. There could be booths or even a little place where there might be a visitor center that went with it. But As of yet, we're not sure that the community realizes the value of this leftover prairie, which is not the world's greatest, but it happens to be the only prairie we have. And it's very good. It has hoary puccoon, and it has a lot of plants that we refer to as associates, plant associates, often associated with other parts of the prairie, and the organisms underneath. Every spoonful of dirt involves lots and lots of bacteria and the like. So then we're looking at regional things. So there's a regional sporting ground. But we have three regional sites, one going past Allerton Park towards Decatur, one going into Champaign with the opportunity to have historic trains go into Champaign, and then one trackage to Clinton. And that one we're worried about because it is not complete. It goes across a lot of flatland, which is not the most interesting for hikers. It has some invasion on the corridor, and people who are biologists and like don't really enjoy having to go through a corridor that's corn and soybeans. They can get corn and soybeans on the county road. And so there's some of us that are interested in prairie that have to admit that this is a corridor that doesn't have a lot of prairie on it, but it could have if people realize the value of the genetic material. And so we've been to court. There's been some invasion, and we don't want to see that. We want to see the contiguity of the line, the relationship. And the most of the farmers have kept the ballast together and have not invaded. Some of them have taken the ballast down, and that's what we're concerned about now. But we have to figure what we can do. There's a mile, the legs of this, the two legs that go off to Champaign and go off to Clinton are near to White Heath. So White Heath is kind of a center. It was the Railroad Museum going to the south, and two potential trails, rail trails, going off to the in other directions. So we're looking at a centenary of White Heath, and we're wanting to take people down to Shady Rest. Shady Rest is 30 acres, and it's just alive with spring herbs, and it has a little bit of bottomland adjacent to the Sangamon River, and some Cerro Gordo moraine upland, and it has a unique truss bridge, and it can continue west a little bit across Madden Creek and up to Lodge. Can we have people to walk down that corridor and get into see Shady Rest from the point of view of a historic railroad? You can get access to Shady Rest by going around the roads and parking in a parking lot. It doesn't have the same get up and go. So can we dream about going down there? And so there's a matter of if you want the railroad to go down there, you have to have ties, and they have to be concrete ties, because we don't have any trees left, hardly. And we don't want to destroy what we have left in order to make railroad ties. And besides the wooden railroad ties, which happens to have the advantage that it'd be able to wriggle a little. Flat concrete doesn't do that. So We're talking about the possibilities of creating a polymer tie, which would be partially concrete and partially polymer, which would have the ability to wriggle a little bit when a heavy railroad wheel ran over it. There's a little bit of dreaming there. And on the other end of White Heath, there's a little dreaming of rerailing 4 miles of Heartland Pathways trackage. We have to get to the stage that is very similar to what Grand Prairie Friends is doing. We have to have people work on some of these sites to take out trees going down to Shady Rest, to interpret. You need artists. We have a Grand Prairie Friends has a very good annual report, which involves a lot of artistry. So you're combining art and education and science or biology. And we have to encourage people who have enough local clout, enough state clout, enough federal clout to make this line a possibility. At the Clinton end, there's 5 miles, which joins Clinton Power Plant Lake and Weldon Springs State Park, would be a wonderful connection. But you have to make sure that you're not encouraging enemies by moving fast. You have to explain that the recreation will be more important than the prairie in this case. The rail to trail movement was created in the late 1980s as a result of there having been a Stigers Act in the early 1980s, which allowed short line, obsolete railroad lines to close out. Well, they were worried that they were losing some connections and good railroad bed, and it would take a fortune to replace them. So they created at the congressional level in Washington Rail Banking Act, which is called interim trail use, where bicyclists and hikers can occupy the line, and they give the railroad people, the biking people, funds to convert the abandoned bed into a trail that will preserve the railroad dignity, and the railroad can come back if it wants, but often might not, not for years. Many of our railroad beds that are abandoned will never be instituted again, but that opportunity is there. And the Congress felt that some of these railroad beds needed to be preserved for possible reuse. It might be in a different style with different technology. And so we have three legs around Monticello, which is sort of a rural hub for East Central Illinois. It has some rolling hills, and it has a river, and it has an antique town, and industries that are not overwhelming, and accessibility with highways, and it has people who use the town as a retreat, a bedroom community where they can be near enough to Champaign-Urbana or Decatur, and have a sort of a relaxed situation. You know, you have an interesting railroad museum. And so how do we tie our three legs around the existing an attractive Monticello. And the tourists like it. The tourist money is coming in. So you have to figure that if we're going to save any of the natural vegetation, the habitat that a bird will use and travel along, or a beetle or a bug or a lizard or whatever will enjoy, we have to say to the public that these communities are little villages and townships along the way will benefit a lot from an extended trail. So instead of working with the prairie paradigm, you work with the recreational paradigm. It's hugely precedented that most towns on these railroad trails benefit economically and sociologically, and they upgrade as a result of the trails. So we want to maintain that contiguity, and we need to talk to people who might look on our railroad bed as unused agricultural land, wasted land. But we want to say that in that little pieces of bed that are preserved, this genetic material, and we need to say we don't know too much about what's there, and we don't have a lot of it, but if we're to save that corridor, we have to save the rail trail movement along it and to the end where Clinton Power Plant Lake and Welland Springs can be connected, and you run into Clinton. And we don't go right into Clinton, but we go into an industrial area where there's an active line, short line. So we're thinking we need to be able to communicate with people who are heavier than we are, that to let people know that their tax base of their value of their property will go up as a result of this. And the towns like St. Joe at the moment is enjoying the fact that people come to the end of the 7 miles that's open there, and they like to go to a restaurant. Gradually, things can change without being overly dramatic or crass. And so this all adds to a regional center that is unique in East Central Illinois, which is mainly farming, but you have this sort of enclave that people enjoy and visit. I think I have to stop there because I like to see that WEF gets a chance to express itself. We're very dependent on WEF and the Havana Public Television and a whole lot of people who become visitors or a party to our broadcasts that go up on YouTube and broadcast locally on a channel. We haven't put in pictures lately, but that's part of the problem of the virus and not being able to coordinate that as easily as when we were in the studio. So I encourage you to be interested in this sort of not-for-profit organization that I was sitting in the middle of last night. And I was proud to have someone here who has been an early citizen here and an early student here and has a son here. And some of the electronics that are happening are allowing us to examine things that we never did examine before. So we hope to keep this corridor afloat with its minimum of vegetation on either side. And I'm going to finish now. This is Dave Monk, your Perrymont, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
This is WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM.